A little bit earlier this summer, after quite a lot of debate, Congress passed the Central American Free Trade Agreement. CAFTA, as it's generally known, would take down trade barriers between the United States and six other countries: Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. This was something that the Bush administration had been arguing for a long time, making the argument that by making it easier to trade and exchange goods between the United States and these countries, it would be both good for American industry and manufacturers who could more easily sell there, and also for Americans who would have the opportunity to buy the products coming from these countries. It was also the case that some industries here in the United States opposed CAFTA and argued very strongly against it, raising concerns about competing with lower-priced goods that would be coming from these countries into the United States. One of the industries that spoke loudly against CAFTA was the textile industry. Another was the sugar industry, concerned about imports of cheaper sugar and the fact that, at least as they argued it, Americans who grew cane and sugar beets and people who worked in the sugar industry would be hurt by CAFTA. Also, this debate was taken as an opportunity by some people who had perhaps longstanding concerns about America's sugar policy to take some shots at what they call big sugar and argue, in fact, that Americans were paying more than the world price for sugar and that those profits were going into the pockets of the people in the industry. Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about sugar, not in a nutritional sense, as we sometimes do, but as a commodity, and talk about U.S. sugar policy. And our guest for the program is Patrick Westhoff. He's program director with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute and research associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics at the University of Missouri. He grew up in Iowa on his family's dairy farm, has his academic training in the areas of political science, in Latin American studies, and also in ag economics. He served, before going to Missouri, he served 4 years as the chief economist for the Democratic staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. He also served in the Peace Corps in Guatemala back in the late 70s and early 80s. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief in their comments. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But questions are certainly welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if you would be listening around Illinois and Indiana, some of those places where the signal will travel naturally, and if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And of course, anybody listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. So once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Westhoff, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
I certainly appreciate it. One thing that I want to talk about right at the beginning that confuses me a good deal has to do with the price of sugar and the prices, the relative prices that people in other countries pay and that Americans pay. And as I said, in a lot of the stories that were written about American sugar policy in regards to CAFTA, people made the point that Americans were paying something over the world price for sugar, and they said that was because of the kind of import controls and price supports that are paid to the American producers. Now, if you do something like GOAT, as I did, go to the website of the American Sugar Alliance, which is an organization that represents people who grow cane and sugar beets and also the people who work in processing and refining and so forth, you will see something very different. In fact, on their website, it says right now that U.S. retail sugar prices are 22% below developed country average. So I'm hoping this is not so complicated a question that we can't discuss it in a way that people can get. But I guess my question is, so what's the truth about American sugar prices?
It is complicated, but let's see if we can work through it here. The world price of sugar is what people refer to as the price that the Brazilians, Australians, others are selling sugar in the market without any substitute, without any special arrangements. That price of sugar is very low, usually on the order of about 10 cents a pound. The domestic price in this country for a similar type of sugar is usually around 20 cents a pound, so we're much higher than that price. What the Sugar Alliance folks might be pointing to would be, again, the average price in developed countries, which include prices in the European Union, Japan, and elsewhere, which also have very protective policies for their sugar industry.
Hmm.
So the price in Europe, the price in Japan is much higher than it is here. So if you take an average of all developed countries, you know, that would give you a price that would be even higher than the U.S. price.
So it sort of depends on what you're counting and how it is you count, that if you added, if you looked at the price, did an average of the world price, then indeed you would say that, yes, Americans pay more. But if you say to compare just the United States with Britain or with France or with Japan, then American sugar prices would be, are they competitive with the developed country prices, or are they actually average on the average less?
On average, they would actually be less than the prices in Europe or in Japan.
Hmm. What ultimately goes into the price that Americans pay for sugar? And I guess here I'm interested in going to this question of the price supports for sugar, import controls. If indeed we are paying more than than the average world price for sugar, why is that the case?
Well, part of it was something you mentioned earlier. We do have restricted imports of sugar. The world price, again, the price that Brazil, et cetera, would sell their sugar for is on the order of 10 cents a pound. We charge a very large tariff on any imports above a certain amount. So if we want to import more than what's called our tariff rate quota of sugar in a given year, the tariff on that sugar is on the order of like 15 cents a pound. So very little, in fact, almost no sugar moves above that level of tariff. So the only sugar we import is within this tariff rate quota that keeps our domestic supply somewhat limited. And on top of that, we have a price support program that keeps the price of sugar from falling too far.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things come together to mean that our domestic price of sugar is very tougher to get below 18 cents a pound for raw sugar in New York.
And most of the sugar that's consumed in the United States is produced in the United States?
Yes. We would consume about 10 million tons of sugar a year in this country. Of that amount, roughly 8 to 8.5 million tons would be produced domestically.
Does the United States export sugar?
We export a very tiny amount of sugar on the order of a couple hundred thousand tons a year, much less than we import.
Mm. Is this a big industry in the United States if you take a look at all of the various people that are employed, all the way from those people that grow sugar cane and sugar beets and people who work in the factories and everybody that you can associate with the production of sugar, not what you go on and make with that, but just the stuff that comes in those bags that we go down to the grocery store and buy?
Right. If you look just at the farm level side of this, we have roughly $2 billion a year in cash receipts going to sugar cane and sugar beet farmers in this country. That'd be roughly 1% of all the cash receipts in American agriculture. So it's not a huge part of American agriculture, but it's not a negligible part either.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to look at the upstream industries, yes, we have lots of people employed in making various sugar-containing products and selling those in stores around the country.
Well, just to stay with the size of the industry, 1%, that's not very much. But if you take a look at the kind of influence that the industry has in being able to argue for and perhaps secure policies that benefit it, is this an industry that has power in Washington?
It is an industry that has done a very good job of arguing its case in D.C., no question about it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was interested in talking about was ultimately what the price of sugar means for American consumers. And I'm thinking back to something that was here, a story in the state of Illinois not all that long ago, and that concerned the fate of the candy maker Fannie Mae, which had operated in Chicago for a long, long time. And essentially, they went out of business. Somebody else picked up the name and the product to carry it on, although it's nothing like it was. And in some of the stories that were written about what happened with Fannie Mae, there was a commentary generally about the fact that the city of Chicago at one time was a pretty big candy producer. And there were some very large companies mass producing large amounts of candy. And that over time, that as an industry and an employer in Chicago had really declined. Some of what had happened is that some of these companies had actually moved their production out of the United States and had moved it to Canada. And a lot of the reporting said that, at least it was coming from the the candy makers, they said, well, the big problem was the price of sugar, that they couldn't survive with the price that they had to pay. And so either they closed down or they moved their production someplace else. And I think the people in the sugar industry, their response was, well, this doesn't have anything to do with the price of sugar. This is about labor. And what they're doing, the reason that if they're going to relocate their factory outside the United States, it's not because sugar is expensive. It's because the labor is cheaper. And it seems that the two sides here went back and forth on that. Can you say something about the relationship between the price of sugar and the industries that then use that sugar and do something with it?
Sure. I think it's clearly the case that the price of sugar paid by manufacturers here is indeed higher than it would be in some other countries. That would provide manufacturers in the country a bit of an advantage. But I think it's also correct to point out that it's a relatively small part of the cost of most sugar-containing products. So obviously things like labor costs do make a huge difference as well. So again, in that sense, both sides of the argument have at least some merit because both those factors are at play. It is true if you look at our overall trade balance in sugar-containing products. As recently as about 1995, we were roughly self-sufficient in sugar-containing products. We would import and export about the same amount. We're now importing about 600,000 tons more than we're exporting of sugar-containing products.
Mm-hmm. And is that this combination of the two things, labor costs and the cost of the materials, that has driven some what had been U.S.-based production outside of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, both are factors. Now, if you're just comparing 1995 to today, the relationship between U.S. prices and world prices is really no different today than it was 10 years ago. So that wouldn't have caused a change that would have occurred over the last 10 years. But clearly it is a factor in the overall cost of producing candies and other products.
Mm-hmm. So I guess just to resolve this, I'm back on this point of the relative contribution that your labor cost and your sugar costs play. While they're both in there, it sounds as if you're saying that if you had to ask which of those was more important, that probably it would be the cost of the labor slightly more important or somewhat more important than the cost of the sugar.
Again, it probably depends on the product, but for a lot of products, I would say that's probably true.
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Patrick Westhoff. He is the program director with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute, and he's also a research associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics at University of Missouri. And we're talking this morning about sugar as a commodity, and talking a bit about U.S. sugar policy. Questions are welcome. We have somebody here standing by and ready to go. Others are certainly welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Indiana on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. First one, if I'm not mistaken, I remember this sugar thing going on since I was in grade school in the early 50s. So the second question basically responds to... Can you give a history of the in and outs of all this stuff, if you can? And secondly, who do we export sugar to and why? Is it tied up with some kind of trade agreement, or is it a country we'd like to be on our side so we sort of feed them things that, you know, will help out their economy, or exactly what? Thanks a lot.
Okay.
We've had a sugar policy in this country for a very, very long time. It has been fairly stable over the last about 20 years or so, where we've had a what's called a loan rate for sugar that provides kind of a minimum price for sugar. If the price tries to fall below that level, the government agrees to buy up whatever surplus there might be on the market. At different times, we've had or not had marketing allotments as well to try to control the domestic supply. We've had limitations on imports for quite some time as well. That doesn't mean that the policy has been constant forever. We had a time in the early 1980s where there was no price support program, for example, and we had actually a shortage of sugar in this country, and prices were very high, needed the import sugar to supply the domestic marketplace. Over time, our production has increased relative to our consumption. While we're still a net importer of sugar, we don't import nearly as large a proportion of our total consumption as we would have, say, in the 1980s, early 1980s especially. So there are some changes that have occurred. But in general, the policy has been fairly stable over the last 20 years. I would say in terms of our exports, again, our exports are relatively small. I want anyone to come away thinking we're a big exporter of sugar. Quite surprising to some folks, so one of our major markets for sugar last year was actually Mexico, of all places. We often think of Mexico as being a possible issue of a country that could become an exporter to us of sugar in the future. But last year they had a bit of a shortage in their own domestic market and bought some U.S. sugar.
That seems, I guess I'm surprised to hear that, given that I would expect that people in Mexico, if they wanted to buy sugar, could go somewhere else in the world, perhaps somewhere in Central America, for example, and buy sugar for less than what they could buy it for in the United States.
And they did buy some Guatemalan sugar last year, you know, so it wasn't just U.S. sugar that they purchased. I think it was a relatively modest amount. Hmm. For the most part, the U.S. is still an importer of sugar.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. Next is another Indiana caller on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Why, hello. Say, I have a question regarding this recent CAFTA as it relates to sugar and the potential impact on the corn sweetener industry. Does your guest anticipate any reduction or any competition with the result of CAFTA with corn sweeteners in the United States?
Sure. There will be some increase in U.S. imports of sugar from Central America because of the agreement on the order of 100,000 tons a year, growing a bit over time. That's relatively small compared to total consumption of 10 million tons a year of domestic sugar. So we're probably not talking about big changes in sugar prices, and therefore certainly not very large changes in high fructose corn syrup prices. Currently, HFCS is priced quite a bit lower than sugar in the domestic market. Most of the sugar, most HFCS that we use in this country is for soft drinks. It's pretty much taken over the entire soft drink market. And so until and unless we saw a very large change in sugar prices, we probably wouldn't see much of an impact on the HFCS market.
Yeah. Okay, so don't need to anticipate a much reduction in corn prices.
Yeah, I would not expect much of an effect on corn prices as long as we keep our current sugar policies in place.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's talk with somebody in Belgium over near Danville, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Your previous caller just touched somewhat on the question I was going to have, and that's the aspect of what corn, high fructose corn syrup does in relation to sugar prices and stuff. Now, you support the prices of sugar, and we also support to a lesser degree the agricultural aspects of corn. Can you describe what the competition between these two groups must be?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how the policies have arrived over time. If you'd gone back to like 10 or 15 years ago, you would have found the corn industry being very, very interested in sugar policy, because they saw, incorrectly so, that what happened with high fructose corn syrup depended very much on what happened with sugar. But as time went on, we came to the point where HFCS pretty much took over the entire soft drink market. And there really is practically no sugar being used domestically for producing soft drinks anymore in this country. So it's almost as if it's two separate markets anymore. And the price of HFCS, you know, tends to run about 13 cents a pound, while the raw sugar price is about, you know, 20 cents a pound. So there's just not a lot of competition head-to-head in markets for sweeteners. If you can use HFCS, you do. If you can't use HFCS, you use sugar. Now, that isn't to say that corn farmers don't care about sugar policy. If you were to actually completely free out the sugar market and let the price of sugar in this country fall all the way to the Brazilian price, you know, then you would start having a big effect on HFCS as well.
And the two are not really interchangeable?
They are in some uses. Again, you could use sugar in soft drinks, and many countries still do use sugar in soft drinks. Like Mexico still uses sugar in soft drinks. But given current prices, there's not much reason to do so. So right now, as I said, you know, HFCS has pretty much taken over that market. If you talk about table sweeteners, we haven't really come up with a way of making HFCS into a table sweetener yet, so it has, you know, that hasn't taken that market at all yet.
That's what I was referring to. The HFC doesn't seem to be making too much of an inroad into the actual granular sugar.
That's right. That's right. There are some, you know, some processes where there is indeed some substitution. So I don't want to get carried away here and say there's no substitution between the two, but there's not a lot right now.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I'm glad that the caller, previous caller, raised this question about corn sweetener, because it certainly was something I was interested in talking about and looking at these two industries, because, as you say, in the past, while they might have been seen or seen each other as competitors, that, and certainly it was my understanding that people who were in the business of producing corn sweeteners were certainly were supportive of sugar policy because it maintained the price at a certain level and it made it possible even for them to underprice their product and still make money.
That's right. I mean, if you're producing corn sweeteners, you don't want the price of sugar to fall too low.
Right. But now that kind of relationship that existed there in the past just doesn't again, just to go back to what you said, now it seems that people who produce corn sweetener, just because they've become so dominant in a certain sector of sweetener use, they don't care what happens with the price of sugar anymore?
Well, again, they don't care if it's just a small change you're talking about. If you're talking about changing the price of sugar by a penny or two, it doesn't make a lot of difference. If you were to bring sugar prices all the way down to the world price level, then it would be a big deal. Because then we would be talking about sugar, you know, perhaps taking back some of the soft drink market.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a big deal if you were to get rid of all policies. But that doesn't seem to be in the cards anytime soon.
We are near the midpoint of the show. Let me just, for the benefit of anybody who's tuned in here recently, very quickly introduce again our guest, Patrick Westhoff. He's a program director with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at University of Missouri. He's also a research associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics at University of Missouri. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As I said back at the beginning of the program, folks here in the sugar industry in this country were concerned about CAFTA and the possibility that it would open the door to imports of cheaper sugar from outside the United States, and that would be bad for them and bad for their industry. And as you noted, one of the things that will happen with CAFTA is that we talked about in the past that there had been restrictions on the amount of sugar that could be imported, and that what will happen now is that it sets a newer ceiling for sugar imports, and that over a period of time that will go up year by year over the years.
That's right.
Given how much sugar we produce and how much sugar we consume, will the increase in imports from these countries, from the CAFTA countries, truly, will that have, do you think, much of an impact on the American sugar industry?
Well, of course, if you're a U.S. sugar producer, every ounce of sugar coming from other countries of sugar is an ounce of competition you don't want to have. So there's some effect on prices and some effect on production levels in this country. It gets a bit complicated because we have a sugar allotment system here as well. And the way that system is set up, under normal circumstances, we try to peg the amount of production we're going to have in this country to be matching demand we have plus our imports. So what happens is if you start importing more, that allotment may get ratcheted down a little bit, so domestic producers won't be allowed to produce as much sugar in the future as they might have wanted to otherwise. So, either way, that's not a good thing. If you're a sugar producer in this country, you're either going to have less production or a lower price, or maybe even both.
Mm-hmm. So who does that affect the most? Is it the kind of thing that would be felt most by the people who grow the cane and the beets, or is this the kind of thing that would be felt more acutely by the processors, by the people who then take the raw product, it goes to the factory, then it gets ends up being made into that white granular stuff that we have on our tables and that we use in cooking and use in a lot of other products.
Sure, there'd be an effect on both groups, but I think it's probably safe to say the larger effect would be at the producer level. Because the folks who are making the final products, they'd have more imported sugar to work with to make those final products in many cases.
Mm-hmm. I talked a little bit earlier about the fact that one of the things that I had done was looked at some of the information that was on this website of the American Sugar Alliance, which is, a kind of a trade association that represents the interests of people who grow sugar beets and sugar cane, and also people who are in the processing industry. So, it represents the interests of everybody from the field where the raw product is made all the way through to the finished product, and does indeed include the people who grow the two basic stocks, the cane and the beets. Do sugar cane growers and cane farmers and beet farmers are their interests different in any significant way?
They're similar in that both groups, of course, want the best price for as much sugar as possible. So in that way, they do have a common cause, and that's why you'll see that in most policy discussions, they'll be working together. It is important to note, though, that there's very different characteristics of cane farmers versus beet farmers. Cane production in this country is primarily in the states of Florida and Louisiana, with smaller amounts in Hawaii and Texas. Beet production occurs largely in the Red River Valley of North Dakota, Minnesota, Idaho, and a handful of other states. So different geographic regions, obviously, but also different scales of operation. More than half of all the sugar cane produced in this country is produced on farms that have more than 2,000 acres of sugar cane. More than half of all sugar beets produced in this country are produced on farms with less than 500 acres of sugar beets. So the sugar beet farmers, on average, at least, are much smaller scale than sugar cane farmers. That affects how they might think about if there were some changes in the program in the future that might involve government payments. You know, they might have different views about how those programs might or might not work for their interests.
I want to talk perhaps in a little bit more detail about the sugar policy and those things that have been put in place to try to provide support for people who raise the cane and the beets, and perhaps also for the industry, the processing industry. And we've talked about, in passing, we've talked about a number of these things. And basically, there are three. There are price supports, which have come and gone over time. There are marketing allotments. There are import restrictions. One further question about import restrictions. Does this differ from country to country or from region to region, or is there some sort of a global figure set for all sugar imports from any place coming into the United States? I mean, how exactly does that work?
There is a tariff rate quota assigned to each country, so every country has the ability to sell up to a certain amount of sugar to the U.S. at a very low tariff rate. If anybody wants to sell more than that a given amount of sugar, they have to pay a very high tariff on any imports into the United States, so it has the effect of limiting imports. Those allocations depend in part on some historical shares in the U.S. market. You'll find that countries that are no longer very major exporters, like the Philippines, for example, still have a significant export share into the U.S., whereas a country like Brazil, which is by far and away the dominant player in the world market, only has the right to sell a very small amount of sugar into this country.
So do those allotments, that is the amount that any given country can send in the United States short of these kinds of tariffs. I mean, does that get tangled up? It must surely get tangled up in the political relationship between the United States and that country, and whether we consider them mostly friendly or whether they consider them big competitors or whatever.
No, that's certainly true, and it's not a coincidence that we don't have any imports from Cuba, for example. You know, that is indeed because of foreign policy reasons. But I would point out that there's a lot of sugar that moves in world markets. The countries that have the ability to sell sugar into the United States or into the European Union under preferential trade agreements, you know, are doing a lot better in the sugar industry than the countries like Brazil, like Australia, who are selling most of their sugar, whatever the rest of the world market can bear.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that most of the sugar that's consumed in the United States is actually produced in the United States. For our imports, are there, and you also talked about the fact that as far as sugar production is concerned, one of the world leaders would be Brazil. And the fact that actually, though, given that fact, a small percentage of the sugar that comes into that's imported in the United States comes from Brazil, comes from other places. Where are the major sources of imported sugar from?
In this country, largely Philippines, Guatemala, Mexico in some years, although not so much the last couple of years, and just a wide variety of countries have the right to sell a relatively modest amount of sugar, some Central American countries, some Caribbean countries.
The business of the marketing allotments, I'm interested in how that works. And is there actually some sort of direct way that the government has to influence how much cane or beets are planted?
Right. There's each individual company that processes sugar is given an allotment of how much they can market in a given fiscal year. And so if they try to market more than that amount, you know, they just can't legally do so without having to go through a lot of problems. So they will tell their individual growers that they don't want them to grow more than a certain amount of sugar in a given year. Otherwise, that company will be stuck with stocks that they can't get rid of. So it does make a big difference in the actual production levels in some years. It doesn't mean that production exactly matches the allotments, but usually comes fairly close. The allotments are put in place to try to keep, in part, to keep down the cost of the sugar program to the government. We have an open-ended commitment to buy whatever sugar the market wants to offer at a given support price. But we also have a legislative restriction that says that the sugar program should operate at no cost to the taxpayer. So to make those two things happen together, we have to restrict the amount of production that occurs.
Mm-hmm. So there you touch on a point that goes back to some of the debate over CAFTA and some of the criticisms, or one would even say attacks, that were made on the industry over the kind of policy that we have. In fact, the industry of itself says just what you said, that the policy, the sugar policy, doesn't cost American taxpayers anything. Although it's interesting that they also make the point that it operates as a loan program, and they say it involves no subsidies. It seems to me that's kind of a matter of semantics, what you consider to be a subsidy or not. Well, I guess it is true that it operates at no cost to taxpayers. I suppose it is also true that, as critics have argued, that ultimately consumers do pay the price if only in the price that they pay for finished goods that contain the sugar.
That's right. We economists say it's a program that operates at little or no taxpayer cost on average, but does indeed entail significant consumer cost relative to a policy that didn't have any restrictions on imports.
And just the third thing, so we've talked about these three things, talked about import restrictions, we've talked about marketing allotments, and the other is indeed price supports, and it works like price supports for other commodities do. There's a target price that if the price goes below that, then the government steps in. Right,
that's a shorthand version of it. It's a loan program, so you place your sugar under loan after it's been harvested, and then as long as the price stays above the loan rate, you have an incentive to repay your loan. But if the price falls below the loan rate, you have the option of just forfeiting the sugar to the government instead of repaying the loan.
Mm-hmm. So that can you make the argument? Would somebody make the argument that might not be called a subsidy, but in fact that it is a subsidy?
Well, it definitely has the effect of providing a support to the price of sugar, and for WTO purposes, the World Trade Organization purposes, it does count as a subsidy, even though there's no taxpayer expenditure involved on average. It does provide, you know, support to the price of sugar higher than it would be in the absence of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So that counts as a subsidy for WTO purposes.
Apparently, during some of this debate that went on that we followed in Washington about CAFTA, some people suggested that the sugar industry, that it move away from the protection that comes with these high tariffs in favor of something else. And some sort of green box payments. And I'm not exactly sure what that is, but maybe you can explain that. Is that indeed, do you think that, and then perhaps the ultimate question is, do you think that it is likely that any time in the near future, the kind of sugar policy we have that rests on these three legs to try to support the farmers, price supports, the marketing allotments, the import restrictions, that in fact any of that's likely to change much, if at all?
Well, I think one very important challenge will come in 2008 when, under the terms of the NAFTA agreement, Mexico will have the right to sell us as much sugar as they want to sell us. Now, as I said before, currently Mexico actually last year was an importer of sugar, so they wouldn't have had any sugar to sell us anyway. But many people speculate that in the future there's a good chance that Mexico could become a significant exporter of sugar and might want to supply, you know, significant amounts of sugar to the U.S. market. If they supplied enough sugar to the U.S. market, it's hard to see how you'd maintain the current policy. So that might be something that might force there to be some change in policy at some point in the future. Now, having said that, as we talked earlier, the sugar industry has done a very good job of protecting their interests. I expect that to be the case in the future. I would not expect to see very high probability of them just giving up on the current policy anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why don't you move to a policy for sugar like that you have for other commodities? Well, that's, you know, that's a more interesting question. You know, why wouldn't we have a sugar policy like, say, the corn program, where you have, you know, not so much something that supports the price of corn, but rather something that writes checks to farmers to provide some support to their income levels? I think the problem a lot of people have identified with that for the sugar industry is, again, how concentrated the industry is, especially in the state of Florida, where if you were going to make payments proportional to how much people produce, you could be talking about extraordinarily large payments just, you know, to individuals. That would probably be very tough to justify politically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons why the sugar industry has been very wary of any proposal that they go to a program like that for corn or soybeans or wheat.
I wonder how the people in the industry feel about the kind of attention that it's gotten, and all as a result of the debate about CAFTA. There's been a lot of attention devoted to it that previously, I can't tell you when the last time I ever read anything, except perhaps going back to this point where there were these questions and these stories about the candy industry around the Chicago area. I can't really think of too many times that I've read much in the mainstream press about sugar and the price of sugar and the sugar industry. I wonder what people in the industry think about the fact that at least now, within the past few weeks, there's been a fair amount of attention devoted to sugar and sugar policy.
They definitely took a very firm stand on CAFTA and, of course, lost at the end of the day and got a lot more attention than probably some in the industry would have preferred that they'd gotten in the process. My understanding is that at least a handful of the representatives and senators who voted for the final agreement in CAFTA, who were from sugar-producing states, didn't do so because they liked the sugar provisions, but rather because they were convinced it was going to pass anyway, and they wanted to make sure that they were going to be in a position to defend sugar producers in the future. So they didn't want to get too far on the wrong side of the Bush administration and of people in the political system in general who might decide to put sugar in the targets if the sugar industry was seen as being the group that defeated CAFTA.
Mm-hmm. We have about 15 minutes left in this Barn of Focus. Our guest, again, is Patrick Westhoff. He's a program director with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. That's at the University of Missouri. He's also a research associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics there at Missouri. And we're talking about sugar and sugar policy. And questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, or in fact, if you might happen to be listening on the Internet, you could call in and use that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, any place else, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller to bring into the conversation, someone listening in Pasotum, and that's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have wondered for some time about the economies of producing ethanol from sugar. I know Brazil and many other countries are basing their energy programs on that. What are the economies here in the U.S. for something like that to happen? I mean, on the surface, one would think it's not very feasible because I don't know of any ethanol produced from cane or beets here in the U.S., but how far off is it from the economies of producing ethanol from corn?
My understanding is that it would be very tough to make an ethanol plant from sugar work, given current economics. Again, with the U.S. price of sugar being where it is, the cost of the feedstuff would just be too great to have that be a profitable enterprise. It's a lot cheaper, a lot more efficient to make ethanol from corn in this country. You correctly pointed out that in Brazil, ethanol is a very major industry, ethanol from sugar. In fact, in Brazil, as I understand, makes about as much sugar into ethanol as it does into sugar for sale as sugar products. So it's a very massive industry there. I was in Brazil last May of 2004, visited a sugar processing plant. That one plant all by itself produced about as much sugar in a year as the U.S. imports from all sources combined, and the same plant also made about the same amount of ethanol as well. Ethanol in Brazil sells for less than gasoline by a fair amount, very competitive in the regions where it's produced, but that's all possible because the price of sugar in Brazil is much, much lower than it is here.
Is there sugar industry, ethanol industry, subsidized much in Brazil that you know of?
There were definitely subsidies that helped the industry get started. There are lots of loans that were offered to the industry and other investment opportunities that were given. There's also some requirement of ethanol use in some certain parts of the country at certain times. So I wouldn't want to say that the industry isn't getting government support, because it is and has. But at the same time, it's not receiving anything like the level of support that, say, the U.S. ethanol industry would be receiving today.
Right.
It's not nearly as subsidized as the U.S. industry would be.
we've kind of hung our hats on, you know, corn prices remaining relatively high, although today they're not, but on ethanol production from corn. But yet, if you, well, from my limited knowledge of it, if you dig into it, there's quite a bit of tariff protection and indirect and indirect subsidy for ethanol production, especially for smaller co-op type production.
There are a number of ways that we support ethanol in this country. You know, we do have the tax benefits offered on all ethanol sold. We do have some of the investment credits that you've mentioned. And we do indeed restrict imports. I mean, there is a very hefty tax on imports of sugar, of ethanol, I should say. So if, that keeps out the Brazilian ethanol.
If that ever goes away, I mean, the government's working at a pretty good deficit now. If we begin to lose those things, how can we compete, I guess, with ethanol from imports, I guess?
Well, if we were to, like, overnight get rid of the tariff on ethanol imports, we would probably end up importing a lot of ethanol from Brazil. I wouldn't say it'd be the entire domestic supply, but we'd import a fair amount from Brazil, I think it's safe to say. For a relatively small change in tariffs or for a relatively small change in our tax policy in this country, it probably would make that much difference.
Okay. I'm kind of hogging the time here, but there's another thing that I've always been curious about is this idea of dehydrating ethanol through plants in Central America and then bringing it on in here.
Right.
What is that process? Can you explain that in a very short time, I guess, simply how that...
I'm not the scientist to explain the physical process, but I can explain the economics, I guess. The Central American countries and the Caribbean countries have the right to sell a certain amount of ethanol to the U.S. without tariff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to 7% of domestic U.S. consumption. That's something that was in place even before CAFTA. I mean, that was a Caribbean Basin Initiative provision from several years ago that is maintained under CAFTA. So what has been talked about is bringing in Brazilian ethanol that isn't in the final stage, have some further processing occur in Central America, and they could sell it to the U.S., you know, taking advantage of the no-tariff policy for the certain amount. So a lot of people expect that there will be some coming into the U.S. in that fashion over the next several years. I just point out that it can only be 7% of domestic consumption. That's a lot, but, you know, not taking over the market.
So is it the key they have to dehydrate it? Is that what they're doing in Central America?
That's my understanding, yes. And, again, I can't tell you much about the actual process involved.
Okay. And one last question, maybe it's a little off the subject, but what, is to your knowledge, is our stage of being able to produce ethanol from biomass? I read in Time that Nebraska is putting in a plant this next year to start producing ethanol from corn stover, they call it. I assume they mean corn stalks.
I believe that's right. Yeah, I think the science behind it is coming along very well. I think we're getting to understand how to do this pretty well. It's once again making the economics work. Yeah, one of the problems we have is kind of a chicken and egg problem. You have to have enough supplies to make a plant worthwhile. The folks are shy of committing supplies to a plant until they know it's going to be up and running.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people think that corn stover, switchgrass, and a variety of other biomass sources could become important ways to make ethanol in the future.
Okay. Very interesting. Sound like you know your stuff.
Well, thanks for the call.
Good talking to you.
All right. Our callers have a little further opportunity here to ask some questions, 7 to 8 minutes. Again, our guest, Patrick Westhoff, he's an agricultural economist at University of Missouri. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things I'm wondering if you know about is how in recent years, sugar consumption in the United States has changed. And I guess it's my understanding that because of health concerns, sugar consumption has declined some, although I'm sure that the average American still consumes an awful lot of sugar. Has it declined enough to make much of an impact on the industry here in the United States?
There were definitely people in the industry very concerned over the last 2 or 3 years about whether the Atkins diet or whatever else is going to cause major changes in sugar consumption patterns. And we saw some drop in per capita consumption of sugar between about 1998 and about 2002. Went from about 72 pounds per capita in 1998 down to about 67 pounds per capita by 2002. And indeed, that wasn't made up on the HFCS side, so it wasn't indeed an overall drop in consumption of sugar products. Since that time, we appear to have held our own. In fact, maybe even increased a bit the last couple of years. So we're all trying to figure out whether this is a sign that interest in Atkins diets is fading or if something else is going on.
Mm-hmm. Also, obviously, one of the things that people in the industry are doing is they, particularly I think in the processing end, people are trying to cut down their cost of production. And that I guess it's my understanding that particularly in the industry, what they're doing is looking at increasing mechanization so that at least they cut their labor costs by having fewer employees. Can you talk a little bit about what has been done successfully or with the kind of approach that the industry is taking to try to indeed maintain a certain level of profit by getting at what it costs to produce the product?
Right, you know, cane and beet production has gotten a lot more efficient over time, you know, at the farm level, and then the processing likewise has gotten more efficient over time. You know, that's part of the reason how you've been able to see wholesale prices for sugar, you know, being in about the same relationship or even a little bit cheaper relative to prices at the farm level over time. So we've seen some efficiencies happen. There's a question of just how much farther you can really push that, though. There's, you know, how much farther can you really go than what's already been done?
Let's talk with someone in Chicago on our toll-free line, line 4.
Thank you. I understand high fructose corn syrup and other things were being exported principally to countries like Mexico and so forth, and they took a stand to say, what do we need high corn fructose for when we've got all our sugar, so why should we import it? I was wondering, the government apparently put a stop to any importation of that fructose. Do you know where that stands at the moment?
Yeah, the Mexican government put in place a 20% tax on the use of HFCS in soft drink manufacturing, and that had the effect of pretty much completely shutting down, but definitely shrinking that industry dramatically.
Yeah,
Mexico's no longer using nearly as much HFCS and not importing hardly any anymore. Mm-hmm. There is a WTO case that the U.S. has taken about this, and indeed there was a panel ruling just this past week that ruled in favor of the U.S. side, saying that tariff was not in compliance with our trade agreements with Mexico.
One other question regarding alternative fuel sources. I understand down in South America they had gone ahead and produced alcohol from the biomasses they have from the sugar cane and all that down there. That seems to be a credible source for alternative fuel. And they seem to not have to be so dependent upon foreign oil. Sugar has its place in the economy. Thank you.
All right. Any further comments you want to make about that?
No, just, you know, again, to agree with the caller that Brazil in particular has made production of ethanol from sugar a very large part of its energy approach.
And we talked about that a little bit earlier with another caller. Well, we're sort of coming down to the point where we have to finish up. Just again to go back as a general kind of question, do you expect, should we really expect any time in the near future the American sugar policy to change particularly?
I do think the 2007 Farm Bill will be a very, very critical time that'll happen. At the same time, we may be looking at a new WTO agreement that'll put pressure on the sugar policy as well. So I would expect there to be some changes, but just how large those changes will be, I think, is very hard to say at this point.
Hmm. Well, we do have one more caller here. We'll squeeze in. Someone listening in Sycamore, Illinois, up in northwestern Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious to know if there is any significant amount of sugar imported into this country from Cuba and the Caribbean anymore, cane sugar, that is.
There's no imports from Cuba that I'm aware of. I think that's pretty much, you know, is prohibited by law. But we do import sugar from the Dominican Republic, from Jamaica, and from a variety of other countries in the Caribbean.
Okay. I was just curious to know that because I think it has some of the best tasting brown sugar that I've ever tasted. And it's hard. I haven't been able to find it, at least not listed as such. But at least I know that it's in here somewhere. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Something else I'm curious, maybe this is in a little different area, but I'm wondering someone has looked at how it is that the increasing use of the high fructose corn sweetener has changed the way that Americans expect things to taste. You know, when we were kids, I'm sure that if you had a soda, it had sugar in it.
Right.
And now it's got corn sweetener in it. And I think that people may indeed have gotten used to it, but some people might say, you know, it doesn't taste right to them, given what they were used to. Has the increasing use of corn sweetener, has that changed the way Americans think sweet things are supposed to taste?
It has to have had some impact, because you're right. I mean, clearly the way Coke or some other, you know, soda would taste today is very different than we've been 25 years ago. We have a very different mix of sweetener going into that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we will finish up with our thanks to our guest for this part of Focus 580, Patrick Westhoff. Again, he's a program director with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute at University of Missouri. He's also a research associate professor in the Department of Ag Economics there. And Professor Westhoff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.